little darling. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Voices from the Front Lines, your national movement building show. Thank you, Nia Simone. This is Eric Mann. I'm your host. I'm in studio, as always, with our producer, Channing Martinez, who helps me in every way. And today and next week are going to be shows to continue the conversation about the positive role of communism in U.S. society and the importance of communism today as a positive influence in a movement that I believe is lost without it. So, you have the name of the guy from the CP?
John Bachtel.
So next week, we have John Bachtel, who is the chair of the Communist Party of the United States. And today, I'm going to do a sort of a long monologue, soliloquy, spoken word, one-man play, stand-up, called A Communist in an Auto Factory by Eric Mann, which is me, and I'll talk about 10 years that I spent as a communist and as an auto worker in the United Auto Workers at the Ford Milpitas plant, the GM Southgate plant, and most of my life in the GM Van Nuys plant, where I did initiate and lead what was called the campaign to keep Van Nuys open. And as I'm working on my own political history and going back to re-understand it, I'm increasingly having an even more positive view of the role that communism has played and does play in my own worldview, even shaping some of the ideas of my own organization, the Labor Community Strategy Center, because there are many groups in society that are not communist that can be positively influenced by many of the ideas of communism. So soon, we're going to get to A Communist in an Auto Factory by Eric Mann, but just a little bit more preface, and then we'll play the Internationale for a minute as the lead-in to my story. This whole thing started, well, it continues, but it started when maybe 2 years ago I was actually talking to someone, one of the leaders of Black Lives Matter, and she was talking to me about why she didn't think we should talk about communism. And she gave the example of a Seinfeld show that portrayed a communist as such a gray, bleak person. And she said, well, we don't want to portray ourselves as gray, bleak people. I said, well, yeah, but that's how capitalism portrays communism. That's not necessarily how communists portray communism. Have you ever seen the film, and I was thinking, Il Postino, The Postman, which was about the famous Chilean revolutionary Pablo Neruda. And for those of you who have listened to the last couple of shows, yeah, we've done this whole conversation. And then last week, I believe, I did a show. No, the week before, I did a show where I did a major review of a film called Neruda that I like, Neruda, which I like very, very much, which is another pro-communist, very pro-communist film. So in the process of that, I was called by a member of the Communist Party USA who said, well, I just heard the tail end of your show. And by the way, we've been getting some amazing, amazing responses to the show. High energy possibilities of people listening, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And she said, are you interested in talking to John Bachtel, who's the chair of the Communist Party USA? He's in town. And I said, heck yeah, I'd love to have him on the show. In fact, we'll have him on for an entire hour, which is next Tuesday at 3. So we'll come back to that. So in the process, I realized, wait, I also would like to talk about my own communist experience, my own thoughts about communism, and continue this as a continuum, as an important theme in Voices from the Front Lines and my own life. So in that context, Lisette, let's do the intro, and then I'm going to do A Communist in an Auto Factory by Eric Mann.
All right, the of our nation. A better world's in birth. No more traditions tamed shall bind, thus no more enslaved, no more enthralled. The earth Sure as a new foundations we have been on, we shall be on. 'Tis the final conflict, let it stand in his place. The international working class shall be the human race. 'Tis the final conflict, let it stand in her place. The international working class shall be the human race.
Yep, that's one of my favorite songs. And I cry every time. Okay, A Communist in the Auto Factory by me, Eric Mann. I worked in the auto industry as a United Auto Workers member and assembly line worker from 1976 to 1986. I went in as a communist, a member of the August 29th movement, a predominantly Chicano communist group, and later as a member of the League of Revolutionary Struggle, a multiracial, multinational Latino, Black, and Asian Pacifica Islander group, communist group, that was in fact a product of the merger of the August 29th movement, which was mainly, as I said, Chicano-Latino, Ewar Kuhn, which was predominantly Asian Pacific Islander, and the Revolutionary Communist League, which had previously been the Congress of African People, which was a Black communist group led by the well-known poet Amiri Baraka. The few white people in LRS, such as myself and my wife Leanne, had chosen to be in an overwhelmingly third world U.S. communist group and been accepted into membership because of their dedication to the struggle against U.S. imperialism and their commitment to self-determination for the Black and Chicano nations inside the territorial boundaries of the United States. Now, I'm going to take you on a long journey as a member of the working class, as an assembly line worker and a communist, and my overall view of that experience and life choice was overwhelmingly positive. As I'll explain below, or later, I eventually left. I resigned from my communist organization out of significant disagreements and my criticisms of what I believed were profound sectarianism and, yes, the League of Revolutionary Struggle's destructive role in the labor movement and the Black and Latino Chicano United Front that I was building. That's what I believed. Today, I think the movement needs to reexamine and to some degree reintegrate the communist experience and many of its greatest achievements to challenge the anarchistic, individualistic, and its own ways equally sectarian present situation cloaked in talk of democracy, horizontalism. Today, people reject what they call hierarchical organizations and charismatic leaders, but I believe we need hierarchical organizations. We need charismatic leaders who I believe are central to any chance of making history against a disciplined and fascistic capitalist state. And I will not go into today a definition of charismatic in a sense, but meaning someone who has power and wisdom and who attracts other people. Martin Luther King was charismatic. Fannie Lou Hamer was charismatic. Every good organizer in their own way is charismatic. They have a magnetism. And the idea to put that down, often by people today that I think are very self-serving and trying to put down the previous history, is not a good idea. Similarly, I think to say hierarchical organizations are dictatorial is very demagogic. You need hierarchy. You need to know who's in charge. You need good leaders. And the concept that we're all equal and that we're all equal leaders just leads to a manipulation of who's in power. Check out the whole Occupy movement that claimed it had no leaders, but I knew who its leaders were. You knew who its leaders were, but you couldn't hold them accountable because they said, well, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not a leader. So while this story will involve a lot of memories and memoirs, I want to be clear that I think the overall communist experience in the United States, both the pro-Soviet CPUSA and the pro-China anti-revisionist new communist movement was and is a positive one and made some important contributions to U.S. history. This is Eric Mann. I'm the host of Voices from the Frontlines. This is you're hearing my voice from the frontlines about my own history, as I'll explain, as a communist in the working class. I would love to receive emails at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines. You can tweet me and I guess even Facebook at Eric Mann Speaks. And we're going to give you a number in a minute that you could call where there's some people from the Strategy Center, 323-903-6328. If after you listen to this, you want to get involved in our work and if you just want to talk to me. In 1989, I went to several meetings describing the fall of the Soviet Union, including some social democratic triumphalism. I remember hearing Barbara Ehrenreich, a social democrat, telling an audience of 2,000 people in New York, "Okay, folks, this is a big victory that the Soviet Union fell. One down and one to go," she said. Meaning, now that communism was down, the social democrats like ourselves would lead the fight against capitalism. But of course, they never did, and they never will, and neither did she. By contrast, I heard Cornel West, a black social democrat, challenge his fellow social democrats. Cornel said, "I'm not sure people are celebrating about the fall of the Soviet Union. We have to ask ourselves, how is it that communism, not social democracy, is the only socialist tendency that attracted black people, while social democracy is virtually all white?" Cornel went on, "And we have to ask how the communists attracted the most disciplined and dedicated people while social democracy did not." Made me ask Cornel, "So why don't you become a communist?" But that was very principled in his part. And then I heard Joe Slovo of the South African Communist Party at the same New York event defend communism and say the South African Communist Party is proud to stand with the black masses of South Africa in the life and death struggle against apartheid. I realized then, having left my communist group in 1984, that I was still part of the international anti-imperialist pro-communist movement as a friend, ally, and comrade, and that has never changed and never will. Now, I first went into the working class by choice in 1973 as a nurse's aide in what was then Peter Ben Brigham Hospital in Boston, now Brigham and Women's Hospital. I've been a very high-profile leader of Students for Democratic Society, and after that of the Weatherman Above Ground Collective in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'd led a militant demonstration against the Harvard Center for International Affairs, a think tank for U.S. imperialist counterinsurgency against Third World and Vietnamese people, similar to the Columbia's infamous Institute for Defense Analysis, against which I had also demonstrated as part of the Great Columbia Strike of 1968. I was punished with a sentence of 2 years in prison, of which I served 18 months, and 40 days in solitary confinement, and I played a role in the prisoners' rights movement and later the Attica Brothers Defense Committee. In 1973, the 60s for me finally ended. I was exhausted and profoundly self-critical of my own battles with ego and searched for some type of personal salvation and reevaluation. I found it on the floor of the hospitals where, without or perhaps, yes, understanding it, I did what the Chinese Communist Party proposed for middle-class petty bourgeois comrades, going back to work with the people, with the masses, in direct manual labor. I love the job of nurse's aide. I got to work with the patients with direct hands-on, taking blood pressures, pulses, and temperature, changing their gowns and their sheets. Well, they always got their IVs caught on the gowns, or as George Wilson, one of my favorite patients, someone told me, "Eric, my man, I don't know what's going to kill me sooner, you or the cancer." Sadly, it was the cancer, but I loved staying with him after his shift, putting skin cream on his beautiful skin, and just talking and talking until I was told by my supervisors that I was over-identifying with the patients, which I thought was a strange reprimand in an age of nobody gives a damn. But I loved my patients, and they loved me, and my life began to get better, and my soul began to heal. You're listening to Eric Mann. I'm on Voices from the Frontlines, of which I'm the host. In 1974, I met Leanne Hurst, and she changed my life. It was truly love at first sight and continues today. She encouraged me to consider joining the new communist movement, and she led a group of us on a journey to investigate the different and already competing and polemicizing so-called anti-revisionist communist groups, meaning we did not like the Communist Party of the United States of America. We thought it was revisionist, meaning it had revised the basic teachings of Marxism and Leninism. It no longer believed in essentially armed revolution. It talked about a peaceful transition to socialism. It was very tied to the Soviet Union, who we believed was a moving towards capitalist system. It was very against China, and we were very pro-China, which was the, we believed, was the future of revolutionary and third world socialism. So there were groups, the Workers' Viewpoint Organization, the October League, the Puerto Rican Workers' Organization, the Communist Labor Party, the Communist Workers' Party, and the August 29th Movement. And they would have these big events. Now, if you can imagine, as Leanne and I were talking yesterday, you don't understand how popular communism was. I mean, you'd be going to events with 500 people wanting to discuss, should we join a communist organization and which one? It was like a communist fair, you know? Now, I liked ATM the best almost from the start. I heard a young Chicana woman from a collective that had been the labor committee of La Raza Unida Party. This was at this meeting of all the different communist groups. She sounded like an organizer first and a communist second, or maybe just a good communist organizer. She talked about the people in ways that seemed grounded and talked about the need for communist leadership of the working class to challenge the trade union bureaucrats and the Democratic Party imperialists. Now, this is important. I want you to hear this. We believe, and I believe today, that the leadership of the AFL-CIO is an agent of imperialism. They support the imperialist wars. They're an adjunct of the Democratic Party. They suppress any kind of serious movement inside the trade unions. They don't allow labor democracy. They make loud noises, or not even loud noises anymore, against corporations, but all they want is a decent contract, and they're often willing to throw their own members to the dogs to get one. I believe that then. I believe that when I was in the civil rights movement, and I believe that now. She talked about strikes that they had organized, work they were doing with Latino workers. She even had a sense of humor. The leak said that political line was key, and what it meant by that was the fight would not be won in the realm solely of ideology, the general and critical first principles of pro-Mao communism. Ideology was critical. You had to understand the fundamental differences, but they would get resolved in the realm of practice. Political line meant the debate about the actual conditions of the class struggle. Should we set up a radical caucus? How should we work with other political forces? Yes, including the trade union bureaucracy. Should we call a strike? And if so, when and how? She also pointed out that the August 29th movement was based on the August 29th, 1970 Chicano moratorium against the war, in which the famous Chicano journalist Ruben Salazar was murdered by the police. This brought up my best experiences in the Congress of Racial Equality, the Newark Community Union Project in the earlier days of SDS, when I was an organizer building actual movements with real people on the ground. Leanne and I approached them surreptitiously and indicated we were interested in joining. But you didn't just join. You don't just sign up for a communist organization. You had to be selected and tested and trained. Finally, I was approached by a Chinese brother who made the message on the phone so clandestine I barely understood what he was talking about at first. But eventually I realized he was telling me I was essentially selected to come in what was called a local committee. A local committee was a communist cell on training wheels, led by a developed communist cadre, in this case, this brother. You began to do work under party discipline. The work was no longer your own, in the good sense of that word. By this time, I was in Berkeley, California, where in 1976, and now an operating room orderly at Alta Bates Hospital. I went to work every day with Emma Stoffel, a brilliant pro-communist dietary worker who had been trained by the pro-Soviet CPUSA. Now, how could I explain to her that while finding her was a true needle in the haystack, my communism actually saw her old communism as the main danger as the pro-Soviet and pro-China parties were at war and in direct competition. Well, so here was the beginning of some of my differences with ATM and later the LRS. Was it possible that with this wonderful communist worker, my main conversation would be to tell her why she was wrong and I was right, that her communism was in fact tied to Soviet social imperialism and its reformist agents in the working class, the CPUSA. I was not just careful but respectful. I did explain to her those differences, carefully and respectfully, but I told her I was so proud to meet a real communist in the working class, and she was thrilled to meet me. And we became friends, by the way, for over a decade. Fortunately, there was an actual, relatively open CPUS leader in our SEIU union local, and she was an aggressive apologist for the union bureaucracy, and she would not support our work to democratize the union or even fight the companies. So Emma began to see the actual work of the CPUSA in practice, and she did side with me and ATM. But even then, I was very careful to win her over without making this into a moral crusade. I did not want to negate her amazing choices as a white, disabled farm worker in Nebraska to have come to California, joined the United Electrical Workers in California during World War II, and spent World War II proudly working in war production. I also loved Alberta Driver, Emma's wonderful friend who also worked in dietary and befriended me as well. Leanne and I loved going to Alberta and Herbert's house on the weekend, where Herbert had set up a little clubhouse in his garage as an Oakland Raiders bar, and he was the spitting image of who I would later come to discover as Cedric the Entertainer. Now, for me, I enjoyed the working class. I enjoyed the work, and yes, loved the individual and advanced workers in particular, who became my friends, not my contacts. And they accepted me and Leanne as communists, if only because they so respected our open and above-board presentation of who we were. Open and above-board is a term that Mao Zedong uses. Open and above-board with the people. Don't hide your politics. Be careful when you say it, but let people know who you really are. They could not for the life of them figure out what a Cornell and Berkeley graduate were doing in the working class, let alone why I would want to vacuum up blood off the floor of an operating room. But what the hell? To each their own, they felt, if it makes you happy to try to organize us, sounds good to us, even if you look crazy, since we would love to get the hell out of the working class if we could. But not really. They, too, liked their lives. I think Herbert was a bus driver, actually. And like many strange bedfellows, life is a lot about chemistry. We worked to fight speed up on the hospital floor, fought for better conditions for the patients, and we built a small rank-and-file caucus that was a specialty of ATM's union insurgency tactical plan. That is to say, building autonomous workers' groups within larger unions and workplaces to both move the union to the left, to move workers towards class consciousness, socialism, and communism. You're listening to Eric Mann. This is my story about being a communist in the labor movement, and I'll get to the United Auto Workers. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm in studio with my friend and comrade and producer, Channing Martinez. And I would love if you would send me emails as the best way at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. You can tweet me at Eric Mann Speaks. Throughout this process, the new communist groups believed that industrial workers, that was called the point of production, were the key to a socialist strategy. There, according to Marx, the factory workers in large-scale production had the capacity to best grasp the contradictions of capitalism. The fundamental contradiction of capitalism is the social production of wealth and its private appropriation. What that means is that the workers collectively produce the wealth, and the capitalists individually say thank you very much and take the profits. The workers could see the extraction of their own surplus value in front of their face. They could see the products they produced in auto, steel, rubber, electronics, heavy basic industry, and given the high amount of profits they produced for the capitalists, their strikes, work stoppage, and political challenges had the greatest chance to bring the system down if the trade union struggle was part of a broader communist struggle. As such, The goal for all of us was to get jobs in the auto factories and be part of the growing insurgencies in the trade unions in the mid to late 1970s, including insurgencies by black and Latino workers against racism, discrimination by both unions and employers. Now, during the 1960s, I had been introduced to the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in Detroit, their amazing Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, Drum, and other Chrysler plants. And just before I moved to Berkeley, I attended a meeting called by Barbara and John Ehrenreich, that's funny, where I met workers from the Ford Mahwah plant, also black workers, and I felt they were among the most charismatic and politically conscious people I'd ever met, and also so grounded, one of the gifts of working on an auto assembly line. Finally, in 1976, I got my break. Leanne had been hired a few months before me at the Ford assembly line in Milpitas, California, right outside of San Jose. I was so happy for her. I once visited her at the factory, and I was beyond overwhelmed and in awe. The noise, the commotion, the large numbers of workers, 5,000 workers, the enormous size of the factory, several football fields of long assembly lines, the Latino, black, and white workers working side by side to build cars for Ford Motor Company. For me, Leanne had gotten the best job in the world. For a communist, that is, and I was both truly thrilled for her, but also sad that I had not been able to get hired, as I had also applied for months. But Leanne was looking out for me. She was among the first women hired by Ford, as she had previously been among the first women hired by De Laval Turbine, another massive industrial factory. The system was under great pressure to hire women in all elements of work, including well-paid, unionized mass production. And Leanne was perfect for the job. This was the product of the civil rights movement. This was a product of the women's movement that under Title IX, I believe it was, of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that women's equality was also critical under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. And so the companies were under pressure to hire women or face civil rights suits. But Ford was also aware of male chauvinism in society as it impacted their profit position and understood the dangers of, quote, insecure husband syndrome, men whose wives had gotten jobs that now paid more than almost anyone else in the working class. And because the specific men I later came to know, especially Gene and Rita and William of William and Mercedes, were such good guys, it was only when I got to GM Van Nuys that I understood that the actual brutality and beatings that many men and husbands put on their wives out of insecurity and misogyny to see their wives happy and, yes, making more money than them and having economic and personal independence. So Ford had a hire a husband program. And through that program, Leanne got me hired at Ford, which, to say the least, changed and shaped the rest of my life. I will not go into the Ford stories and just say I love being an auto worker. And I was so proud that I succeeded at it. I was accepted by the workers and the members of my union. And yet, this was the period of what would later be understood as the deindustrialization of America, as U.S. corporations that enjoyed post-World War II economic advantages over the vanquished Japanese, German, and even allied Soviet economies were reeling from growing international competition. You're listening to the voice of Eric Mann. I'm on Voices from the Frontlines. This is, in this case, my voice. It's a long story of a communist in the auto industry telling you the story of my life and trying to talk to you about the positive role and the positive dynamics between an organizer and the people in an auto factory. So now this capitalism said the hell with Keynesianism or even Fordism, in which the theory was that well-paid industrial workers were needed to purchase the very products of capitalism and keep the system growing. Now the focus was on cutting costs and particular labor costs, meaning wages, and more importantly, the number of workers and the number of plants. Massive layoffs and even worse, permanent plant closings were the rule, and a sense of true terror came over auto, steel, rubber, electronics, and every other worker who had benefited from U.S. imperialism's relatively short post-war boom. And they had believed that their economic conditions and, yes, privilege vis-a-vis the world proletariat were immutable. Well, they weren't. So Leanne and I were laid off in 1977 from the Ford plant. And after months of waiting to be rehired, we began to see the writing on the wall that as low seniority workers, we would most likely never get hired back to the jobs in the union we had truly come to love. Through a set of family choices, we decided to move to Los Angeles, and I sought work at the GM Southgate plant. This is Eric Mann, Eric at voicesfromthefrontlines.com. Love to get an email. Through a true miracle, Southgate was hiring, in fact, was putting on an entire new shift. I was beyond thrilled, and Leanne began packing up our family and get ready to join me in Los Angeles. By the time we were in San Jose at the time, near the Ford plant. By the time we'd sold our house and packed up the truck, I was hit by something even bigger than a Mack truck. Both Mack truck, the real Mack truck in Hayward, California, and now the GM Southgate plant were in danger of being closed, and GM laid off its second shift at Southgate only 3 months after it hired 1,000 new workers, including me. Through another miracle, I was able to transfer over to the last remaining auto factory in Southern California, the GM Van Nuys plant, where my life was indelibly shaped and where, yes, I played an important role in labor, UAW, and, yeah, black and Latino history, as did my union and as did my movement. When I got the GM Van Nuys plant in 1982, I was beyond thrilled, but also terrified. I was terrified of losing my job and terrified that this plant, too, would be shut down and there would be nowhere to go. Now, Pete Beltran was the president, a handsome, charismatic, did I say the word charismatic? Very Indio, Chicano, Mexicano, and one of the most radical and militant presidents of any UAW local in the United States. I could not believe I was lucky enough to work under his leadership. But I couldn't tell him that because just when I got there, Pete was running for re-election as president against another powerful Latino, Cal, who was a very formidable opponent, and it was possible Pete would lose. Now, I already knew about Pete through Locals Against Concessions movement that was taking on the UAW International for giving back workers' benefits to the corporations in turn for a vague promise of them not closing down more plants and laying off more workers. As the election progressed, I understood that Cal and his team were attacking Pete from the right. Our local was an amalgamated union, and there were other small shops that also had votes for president. Cal said that Pete spent too much time helping the small locals and not enough for the GM workers. Pete spent too much time with Cesar Chavez helping the farm workers and not enough time with GM Van Nuys workers. Pete spent too much time on other progressive causes. But also that Pete fought the international too much and would risk retaliation against our local. Wow, Pete sounded great to me. And even if I managed to get hired here after 90 days, what kind of local would I be part of if this truly great Pete Beltran was defeated with this type of reactionary appeal? Appeals I had seen win in other locals and were very dangerous. So I took a very big calculated risk. I invented a new form of organization. New hires and Southgate transfers for Pete Beltran. Now, something you need to know about me, I invent stuff. I make stuff up. There was no such thing. I thought it was a good idea. I went to my comrade Mark Masaoka. He agreed. So we formed this new hypothetical, imaginary, but very true, new hires and Southgate transfers for Pete Beltran. I had to hide behind the Southgate transfers because they had seniority and I did not. So we put out an anonymous flyer in support of Pete. I used a falsely innocent, well, I don't know, but it sounds pretty good that Pete wants to expand the local. Pretty good that he works with the farm workers and supports citywide issue. What a great president. What an expanded view of a union presidency. Now, I did not quote from V.I. Lenin that a communist in the trade union should be a tribune of the people, not a petty trade union secretary, but Pete sure was a true tribune of the people. Now, the flyer had a big impact. It actually shaped the election because we could vote as new hires. And the Southgate transfers were mainly black, and they didn't know what they thought of Pete. But I was truly terrified that the right wing of the union would identify me as the author and get me fired. See, I was a new hire at Van Nuys, and under the UAW contract, I could be fired for any reason the company chose for the first 89 days of my employment. But when I reached 90 days, I would be a recognized union employee with union rights and grievances. So every time my foreman came near me, I was sure he was there to fire me at the instigation of Cal's faction. I was sure I got caught. And I said, why did I do this? I'm a big self-doubter. Why did I do this, Eric? This is, I get it, but you're going to get fired, and then you're fired, and then you'll never get back in the auto industry, blah, blah, blah. Finally, someone approached me. Are you the guy who wrote the flyer for Pete? Oh, shoot. But before I could deny it or act dumb, he whispered, Pete sent me. He loved the leaflet, and he wants you to come to a meeting of his campaign Sunday at his apartment. Oh, my God, I was so thrilled. It was such an honor to be invited, and apparently Pete did know me from the Ford plant before, because I have no idea how anyone found out I wrote the flyer. I went to Pete's house, and I'm telling you, it was like being invited into the inner circle of one of the greatest revolutionary trade union caucuses I'd ever met. There was Pete presiding over it, of course, with about 30 workers who were leaders of every second shift, first shift, all the other little plants that he had helped to organize, black, Latino, white, all working for Pete. And I was part of it. And he introduced me and said, this is the guy that wrote that leaflet that's helped me win the election, which still scared the hell out of me since I didn't have my 90 days, but I did appreciate it. Now, I began to organize something called the UAW Campaign to Keep GM Van Nuys Open. That's a whole nother story, but it does frame the rest of this story about how I worked as a communist. Because Pete trusted me, and because I was totally loyal to him, and I want to take a minute there about loyalty. I was 120, 50, 200% loyal to Pete. Life is about sabotage and betrayal, and I'm a communist, and Pete knew I was a communist, but he also knew I had his back. I would never do anything to hurt him. I consulted with him all the time. I met with him. I said, I explained the moves I wanted to make, because he was the president. And how was this guy? I mean, I was, yeah, a well-known civil rights and student radical, but what does this have to do with the United Auto Workers? Without Pete, I was nothing. Without my relationship to Pete, I had nothing. So I would always make it clear to Pete that I'm working on your behalf, but let me tell you what my agenda is, back to this open and above board. You're listening to the voice of Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. So I came up with this idea. Yeah, I invented another thing called the Campaign to Keep GM Van Nuys Open. It's in my book, Taking on General Motors. The idea was that our local could obviously not do anything to keep our plant open. And yes, it was in danger of being threatened. But if our local organized the black and Latino community to threaten a boycott of General Motors in the largest new car market in the United States, we had an outside chance of keeping that plant open. At a later time, after we do next week our interview with the Communist Party, I will tell you more about that campaign. But just trust the fact that it got off the ground. It was a big thing. And the workers began to believe that we had a chance to keep that plant open against General Motors. So very quickly, I began to function as an open communist. I had a metal shelf behind me for my tools, extra bolts, straps, and screws, but I also used it as a bookshelf and magazine rack. I began to keep copies of the ATM and LRS magazine Revolutionary Cause. It was a very good paper with high literary values, edited by Reese Ehrlich, originally of the Oakland Stop the Draft Week and later a well-known journalist on Middle Eastern affairs. I would ask workers to buy it when they came by my station. So now I'm going to tell you in the last 15 minutes, and thank you for a long frame, a lot of stories about what was it really like to be a communist? What was it like? What was the fabric like? The first thing that was interesting is I'll tell you a story about Nate Brodsky and how he would get workers to buy Revolutionary Cause. Nate came up to me and said, listen, I got five guys to buy the paper. I said, Nate, that's really great because I really want to influence, you know, the workers and move them towards communism. He said, no, I didn't do it for that reason. I told the workers, look, Eric really needs to sell these papers. It's very important to him. He's in a communist group. You know what it's like when he's under pressure to sell these papers, you know, like if you were in, you know, the Watchdog or the Watchtower, whatever it was. He says, so look, isn't Eric fighting for us? The guys would say, yeah. Don't you think the campaign to keep Van Nuys open is our best chance to keep our job? I tell him, yeah, it is. All right, it makes Eric really happy when you buy the paper. So just keep him happy. Buy the paper. You don't have to read it. Just buy it from him. I said, Kate, I said, Nate, that is the most generous and condescending story I've ever heard. It is so trivializing of me, but I'll take it. I'll take it. Because it comes out of love. It, you know, he was in the end selling communist papers. So no matter what he wanted to say, and no matter how he was justifying it, he was ending up selling communist papers. Then Pete came up to me and said, do you need to sell that damn paper? Eric, for God's sake, I get so much trouble about you being a communist. Everybody's coming to my office. I said, everybody? All right, no, but the right wing of the union. All right, the whole right wing? No, but actually Richard Guppy and this guy, and they're saying I'm supporting a communist. I said, Pete, you are. He said, I know I am, but I'm running for president. I'm the president now. He had just gotten elected, by the way. He said, I don't need this, Eric. Just can't you just be a quiet communist? I said, Pete, I am a pretty quiet communist, but I got to sell my paper. My paper is my lifeblood. My paper is my way to be authentic. You wouldn't ask a Christian to not sell the Bible, right, or give out the Bible. This is what I do. He said, all right, all right. I said, Pete, please don't tell me not to sell the paper. He said, all right, can you try to be careful? I said, Pete, how do you sell a paper carefully? He said, all right, get out of here. You're doing a good job. Let it go. So, but the point was, there was an affection, there was a trust. He was problematizing the problem. What was he going to do? His best organizer was a known communist. And he sort of wanted me to not sell the paper, but he was too good a guy, too principled a human being. And I don't know what I would have done. I probably would have, if it came to yes or no, I would have said, okay. I would have said, if that's, I don't agree with you, and I'll come back on you, but I will not defy you. Because you are the president of the local, and we're working together to keep this plan open. But I want to thank Pete for not calling that question. Then we had the story of Marty Grandy. As the campaign took off, we had this wonderful rally in the rain. It's in my book, Taking on General Motors. We had a big rally to keep the Van Nuys plant open when the second shift was laid off. So there was 5,000 workers and 2,500 of us were laid off. And we were scared that that's what we called a plant closing on the installment plan. You're listening to the voice of Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines. This is my continuing soliloquy about a communist in the labor movement. You can also check out my book. You'll have to get it probably in a used bookstore online called Taking on General Motors, a case study of the UAW campaign of GM Van Nuys Open that tells the story. You should check out the amazing film Tiger by the Tail by Mikkel Goldman. Thank God for her, who did such a beautiful film about our work. You can also send me an email, eric@voicesfromthefrontlines. You can tweet me at Eric Mann Speaks, and you can call our office. I'll get you the number in a minute. And just say you want to talk to me. Just read it out, Channing. Thank you.
323-903-6238.
Say it again, please.
323-903-6238.
Thanks. So there are people there, and the main thing you want to say is that you'd like to talk to me and Channing about our work, hopefully, and about any of these ideas, and I will personally get back to you. So one night, I get a call from a guy named Marty Grandy. He's white. It's about 11 o'clock at night. He says, Eric, this is Marty. I said, what's going on? He says, the right wing of the union, I was working on the campaign. I was making calals to people, and Jerry Shreves came in, Richie Guppy came in and started threatening me. I was all alone. They said, you know you're working for a communist. You know Eric Mann is a communist. I said, yes, I do. He says, are you a communist? I said, I'm certainly not. And Eric, you know my wife is from El Salvador, and she's anti-communist as hell, and she's freaked out that I'm working with you. So they say, you got to get rid of Eric Mann because he's a communist. Now, this is Marty calling me at 11 o'clock at night, telling me the story. So I said to them, well, first of all, we're not getting rid of him. He's the head of the campaign to keep Van Nuys open. So they kept saying, are you a communist? And I kept saying, no, I'm not a communist. But then I started saying, wait a minute. Why are you so freaked out that he's a communist? One, he's got the best plan. Two, he's really good to work with. three, he's elevated me into the leadership. He's elevated Kelly. He's elevated Chris. He likes other people. He works good with Pete. And I started, Marty said, I'm starting to get my confidence up a little bit. I said, look, what are you thugs doing here at 10 o'clock at night? I'm trying to keep the plan open. Are you trying to keep the plan closed? And I said, how'd you feel? He says, scared. He said, I felt good. I was all alone. And I stood up to Jerry Shreves and Richard Guppy. I said, I know. I said, in some ways, I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry you have to sort of carry a burden that's not yours. But it is yours, Marty, because that's who I am. And you can't get all the things you like about me and not the things you don't like about me. And he said, I know, Eric. It's all good. I just want you to know I'm a little shaken up because these guys are like thugs. I said, well, you did really good, and that's why we're going to win, you know, because I can't defend myself if you guys won't defend me. And the thing that I'll go on and on about is just like the film Neruda is the more they said, we got to get rid of Neruda because he's a communist, the more they kept saying the word communist, and then every time he made a good poem, people said, wait, if that's a good poem and he's a communist, then maybe I'm more communist than I thought. Or we got to get rid of Neruda because he's standing up against fascism. Or we got to get communist. So I'm telling you, the word communist was used thousands of times about me. So where I was quietly selling my paper and not talking to many workers about communism except a few, the anti-communists were the ones who did my best publicity for me, even though it was very, very difficult. I'll tell you another story. This guy, Mitch Lopez, came up to me. He was a real right-winger. He said, yes or no, Eric, are you a communist? I said, Mitch, are you talking about a pro-Soviet communist or a pro-China communist? You talking about a Trotskyist? Do you think social democrats are communists? What kind of communist do you think I am? He said, I don't know. I'm an anti-communist. I said, well, Mitch, you can't be a good anti-communist if you don't study communism. If you don't even know the difference between the Soviet communists and the Chinese communists, the Trotskyists and the social democrats, how can you ask me who I am? He said, oh, go to hell. I said, all right, go read some Marx and come back, Mitch. So that was the nature of my life. You know, like, damn, man, I couldn't even go to work without blah, blah, blah. But then, one day I was on a bus ride to Sacramento with my union. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. Eric at voicesfromthefrontlines.com. And I hope I'm going to get some hundreds of emails of response. So I'm on this bus to Sacramento. No, I'm going to end because I want to make sure I have enough time. I'm going to tell you many more stories, but I want to tell you some of the ends. That's very important. My own organization, which had helped me a lot, the League of Revolutionary Struggle, brought me in, told me about Lenin and Mao and Marx, taught me about discipline, it changed my life for the absolute better, began to turn against me and the campaign to keep Van Nuys open. It was asking me to do, like I'm just giving an example, the Communist Party of the United States, who's going to be on next week, I was trying to bring people to these rallies against General Motors, right, for the campaign to keep Van Nuys open. So there was a guy in East LA named Rosalio Munoz, who was an open member of the Communist Party, a very good guy in many ways, who was in the immigrant rights movement, been in East LA forever. So the Communist Party saw that I was getting this campaign really off the ground. These rallies were having thousands of people, Jesse Jackson, Jackson Brown, Ed Asner. It was getting to be a cool thing to go to the GM Van Nuys rallies. So Rosalía Munoz called me up and said, look, I'm coming from East LA. I'm going to bring a bus of 50 people. If I bring 50 people, can I speak at the rally? I said, yeah. I said, that's totally fair. I'm trying to get 1,000 people there. Anybody who brings 50 or more people, prove that you have a base on the ground. I'd love to have you speak, and you'll have 2 minutes. So sure enough, he comes with this bus totally filled with Latinos from East LA to support the movement. First, Pete comes up to me and says, don't let him speak. I said, what do you mean? He says, Eric, how many communists do we need? I said, Pete, he's a different kind of communist. He's not even in my group. I don't even like his politics. But fair is fair, Pete. You know, he says, oh, my God, now the union's going to go crazy on this stuff. Then my own organization comes up to me, not the people who worked in the plant, and said, don't let him speak. I said, why? They said, because he's pro-Soviet. I said, for God's sake, I'm trying to take on General Motors. Right now, I'm not taking on the Soviet Union or the Communist Party in East L.A. Am I going to go through every single bus that comes here, and this guy you're going to say is a trade union bureaucrat, this guy is going to be this, this? Could we just let everybody get along? We have tremendous leadership in this movement. I'm an open communist. I'm the head of the movement in many ways. And you're forcing me to get into every single possible fight with people based on, frankly, our organization's petty agenda of competition with other groups. It got worse. They told me that I had to have more fights with my union president, Pete Beltran, who they said was petty bourgeois. They told me to get into more fights with Rudy Acuna, the father of Chicano studies. They told me I was capitulating to petty bourgeois forces because of my friendship with Reverend Frank Higgins and Father Luis Olivares, who were both a minister and a priest. So basically, I'm having a pretty wonderful time building all these relationships, and then I go into these, cell meetings where I'm castigated and repudiated and reproached. And I'm told I'm this and that and this and that. But more importantly, they say, you're under democratic centralism. You have to do what I say. And I'm saying, I'm not going to do what you say. I'm not going to do what you say. I got to get out of here. This is getting pretty crazy. So here's the punchline. In a book called Nation Within a Nation, Kamosi Woodard said that the fighting within the black movement, inside the Black United Front, is treason. And I would say that the fighting among groups inside the movement is cancer. That if we can't, look, we can have plenty of fights, we can have arguments, we could get mad at each other, but the effort to screw each other, to set up meetings. I've been in things where people didn't like my group, and they gave us the wrong directions for where the meeting was, and the wrong date. It's this kind of stuff inside the movement that gets you sick. So communism has a lot of things it needs to do to look in the mirror. I could have a broader conversation with you about it, but let me say this, that life is sort of a set of dialectics. I've moved away from communism because of many of its excesses. I moved away from communism because of some broader theoretical and strategic concerns I have. But I always move back towards it because the problem is that there's another thing called U.S. imperialism. And that's the main danger, folks. That's the system that you have to ask yourself, do you really like it down deep, but you think it needs to be reformed, or do you think it's sick? If you think it's sick, then communism has shown itself to be the very best vehicle for fighting U.S. imperialism. It's why W.E.B. Du Bois, on his deathbed, joined the Communist Party and went to Ghana to live in the Third World, because after almost century of trying to change U.S. imperialism, he just felt that the only way he could change it was moving to Africa and becoming a communist. So I hope you've enjoyed my story. My point is that I want to thank the August 29th movement. I want to thank the League of Revolutionary Struggle. I do, for transforming my life and giving me the opportunity, the encouragement to go into the factories. I obviously want to thank Leanne Hurst for shaping my life in ways that are almost beyond comprehension. And one choice leads to another. One bad choice leads to another. One good choice leads to another. My greatest gift was keeping close to the masses. And I'll tell you sometime, I'll do another show about more, now that I've framed all this stuff, even more stories about what I've learned from the working class, how much they've looked out for me. Today I work on the corner of King and Crenshaw in South L.A. with Channing, with Barbara Lott Holland, with Manuel Criollo, with a whole lot of other people. And we're building something called Strategy and Soul as part of the Labor Community Strategy Center. And you can call us right now at Strategy and Soul at 323-903-6328. 323-903-6238. Next week, we're going to have a full hour with John Bachtel, who is the chair of the Communist Party of the United States. You can go on their website. Check them out. And thank you. Thank you very much. I'm Eric Mann. You've been listening to Voices from the Frontlines. And Lisette, thank you very much for your help. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. Tweet me at Eric Mann Speaks. Call 323-903-6238. You could write to our producer, Channing@thestrategycenter.org. I will see you next week, where we'll have a full hour of conversation to continue the discussion of communism, because, as Nina Simone says, regrets I've had a few, but not too few to mention. And I did it my way and will continue to do it my way, which in the end is the pro-communist way. You take care of yourself. All power to the people. Without exemption, I will have